Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Adam Glick.
And I'm Craig Box. Welcome, everyone, to the first virtual Kubernetes podcast live from Virtual KubeCon, where we are all no doubt attending in our pajamas. Almost all of our news this week comes courtesy of the Virtual KubeCon event, which is currently happening in living rooms and broom cupboards everywhere around the world. I have to ask, you had commented before about your interest in joining the KubeCon 5K. I wonder if that went virtual. Have you been on a treadmill?
Yeah, as the event went virtual, so did my actual running. So although I may be doing a 5K virtually in my mind, I will not be doing it out on the pavement. I give myself a mulligan on that one until we have our next in-person one, but I will keep that goal that when the next in-person KubeCon comes and I'm there, I will be running it and look for other folks to join us in that.
Something else we've had to take virtual is our booth meetup. We like to catch up with everyone who listens to the show at these events. So, of course, this year we've done it on Slack. In the first couple of days of the event, we've set up the #Kubernetes podcast channel on the CNCF Slack. So if you haven't dropped by already, please do say hello. We'll even tell you how to get a sticker. We think it must be time. We'll have to do a special run of KubeCon virtual stickers.
Totally. You could say that's the room where it happens.
Indeed.
Speaking of the room where it happens, I got a chance to see Hamilton this week. I realize, like most of my movie and video watching, I am well behind the times, but there was one of those that's available from Disney. So after finishing The Mandalorian, I was on to this one, and it is a fantastic show for anyone who enjoys musical theater or history or just seeing some really, really cleverly done stuff. Really enjoyed watching that. And now I will replace that with lots of KubeCon sessions that I get to watch this week.
If you need to, I've thrown a little tip on Twitter, which I'm sure we can link to as well, on how to watch these sessions at 1.5 or 2 speed, because hopefully no one out there actually listens to us at 1 speed. I can't imagine listening to podcasts at real time.
I believe you also put it in the Slack channel as well.
Yeah. So if you need that tidbit, you know where to go.
Let's get to the news.
Red Hat's OpenShift virtualization is now generally available. Built on top of the open source KubeVirt project, you can now add virtualization to your OpenShift, including that most enterprise of workloads, Microsoft Windows Server. Also GA is Red Hat Advanced Cluster Management for Kubernetes, an Anthos-like console for managing clusters and their workloads in private or public clouds. Finally, Red Hat announced that they are working with Intuit on the Argo GitOps project, and will be looking to officially bring it into the OpenShift ecosystem.
5 years ago this month, Google announced the general availability of Google Container Engine, or GKE. One rename later, GKE celebrates this milestone by releasing a new eBPF data path built on the Cilium project. With the introduction of eBPF, GKE now supports real-time policy enforcement and the ability to correlate policy actions to pod, namespace, and policy names at line rate with minimal impact to the node's CPU and memory resources.
Stewards of the world's largest container registry, Docker announced changes to image retention to try and shave 4.5 petabytes off their hosting bill. Free accounts will be limited to 100 layer pulls every 6 hours, which your mid-sized Kubernetes cluster may easily exhaust. More importantly, if you don't pay, images that haven't been launched in over 6 months will be automatically removed. Hosting open source projects remains free, but the retention policy appears to still apply, so set those cron jobs up now.
IBM has announced new Power10 processors, which they say are co-optimized for running Red Hat OpenShift. Targeted at the on-premises part of hybrid cloud, the 7-nanometer chips offer 3 times the performance in the same power envelope as Power9 chips, and provide hardware-enforced container isolation designed to be able to protect other containers in the same VM.
A new Kubernetes controller introduces hierarchical namespaces. Built by the multi-tenancy working group and announced by Adrian Ludwin of Google, the project lets you label namespaces with a parent-child relationship, working around the fact that Kubernetes doesn't have support for doing such natively. The controller will then reconcile objects from the parent namespace into the child. You can also allow non-admin users to create namespaces by creating an anchor object, which the controller will then reconcile into a real namespace in the modern Pinocchio fashion.
The OpenEBS project has released 2.0. The milestone was numbered as such due to the general availability of the 3 most popular data engines. It also includes a new high-performance data engine called MayaStore, built for NVMe, which is feature-complete and approaching beta.
Version 1.4 of Containerd has been released, adding support for Cgroups version 2, also known as the Unified Hierarchy. Other features include expanded SE Linux support, support for Windows through the Container Runtime Interface, and support for snapshotters based on shared remote storage.
VMware has been hard at work integrating its acquisitions, and this week they've announced that their observability acquisition Wavefront is now integrated into Tanzu Mission Control, their Kubernetes management platform. Users can now enable observability from the Mission Control console, which will provide full-stack visibility for operators, developers, and SRE teams. VMware is calling this telemetry as a service.
Mirantis has announced that after acquiring the Container team that built Kubernetes IDE Lens, they have also now acquired the Lens project itself. CEO Adrian Ionel first broke the news on episode 110 of this very podcast.
Palumi, who you'll remember if you cast your mind all the way back to episode 76, has announced a number of new Kubernetes features, including a Kubernetes operator and kube to Palumi and CRD to Palumi for creating strongly typed APIs from YAML manifests or CRDs respectively.
And now, the famous Kubernetes podcast from Google, Lightning Round.
Accurix released an update to their TerraScan security product to add infrastructure as code scanning for configuration files based on the Open Policy Agent.
BitMind, with a Q, has released CAPE, with a C, to help simplify disaster recovery, multi-cluster application deployment, and data protection in Kubernetes.
Cloud66 announced integration of their DevOps tool with OVH Cloud, and that their Maestro tool is now available for development shops to bring multi-tenancy to a Kubernetes-based PaaS.
The CNCF has announced 17 new members, joining a community of 570 other members and end-user supporters. Intuit announced they have upgraded their membership from silver to gold.
Common Computer has released Ionize, an open-source-as-a-service platform that lets you put in a GitHub URL and it will provide you with an API endpoint to that project.
Datadog has released cluster performance monitoring with Live Container to let users view data in the context they need, from orchestrator to container.
Datawire has announced a set of add-ons for increasing developer speed and productivity through faster cluster setup, quicker deployment of code, and traffic management with their Ambassador API gateway.
Elotl launches their nodeless Kubernetes product into the multi-cloud world by making it available across on-premises, Google Cloud, and AWS.
Epsigon added Kubernetes-level tracking to its tracing product to provide a single platform for logs and resource metrics.
Grafana Labs has announced the close of a $50 million Series B round led by Lightspeed Venture Partners.
HAProxy has released an ebook called HAProxy in Kubernetes: Supercharge Your Ingress Routing, which is available in exchange for your email address.
Instana announced the availability of an application process monitoring tool that will automatically detect crashes and provide a root cause analysis for any process managed by their software.
Kubernative has published a release candidate of a security-focused Kubernetes distro called KubeOps.
Kubler and CloudTamer.io have partnered to provide container orchestration and compliance for Kubernetes environments.
NewVector updated their container security product to include compliance templates for PCI DSS, GDPR, and other regulations, as well as adding granular RBAC controls, policy management with Open Policy Agent, and serverless security for AWS Lambda.
Nomata has released their Kubernetes management product for EKS and made it available on the AWS Marketplace.
Sneak, with a Y, has announced their Infrastructure as Code product, which scans Kubernetes and Terraform files for configuration security issues.
SoCube, a consulting company, and Hydora, a Swiss cloud provider, have teamed up to provide HiCube, a managed Kubernetes service.
Styra has announced a long-term support release of Open Policy Agent, as well as a new online academy for free OPA training.
And finally, Sysdig announced a new piece of security research stating that 58% of containers run as root, which you probably shouldn't do.
And that's the news. Constance Karmanolis is the co-chair of this week's KubeCon EU conference. She's a principal software engineer at Splunk via their acquisition of Omnition, contributing to OpenTelemetry. She previously worked in Lyft's data platform and server networking teams, where she built, deployed, and configured Envoy internally and maintained the open source project. Welcome to the show, Constance.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How was your flight? Did you get over the jet lag okay?
Oh, that's really good. I wasn't expecting that.
But seriously, your career so far has spanned quantum communications, mobile communications, and now network communications. Is this a theme?
It was, I guess, an accidental theme. I guess maybe it's kind of obvious that I do like to communicate based on like being on podcasts. And I know that we're later going to talk about the various conference presentations I've given. But mostly like my career has been very accidental, where like either I've met someone and be like, oh, that sounds really cool, let me go work with you. And so it's more been like, I follow the wind wherever it takes me.
So you say you worked on quantum communication. How can you be sure?
I wasn't sure. To be fair, like when I was working on quantum, it would be 20 minutes I would understand something. The next 20, 30 minutes I'd be totally lost, and so I wasn't really sure if I did the right thing.
All I know about quantum communication is that you have the tri-state, the yes, no, and the maybe.
Yes, that part I do remember, but everything else about quantum, I kind of forgot. It's been a long time.
You moved from that world into the world of network proxies and network communication. Was that an intentional shift, or was that one of the first of these happy circumstances that has led you where you're at?
Maybe not the first, but like one of the many happy circumstances or like choices that happened and ended up there. I guess to kind of talk about how I ended up working at Lyft and on Envoy was that when I was looking for a new job when I was at Microsoft, I ended up having coffee with Matt Klein, and we ended up having one of those, I describe it as one of those perfect coffee work dates where he was talking to me about, I think they had just done ingress into all their services. And I was like, oh, are you about to do egress? Well, granted, I didn't know the term at the time. He's like, yeah, exactly that. And then we bonded over all of our very similar ideas around testing and rolling things out. We're just like, oh my goodness, I want to work with this person. I have no idea what networking is. To be fair, like barely knew anything about H2P, but it's like, I just want to learn from you because you sound really awesome. And at least we see eye to eye around testing and how to roll things out. And so I kind of just accidentally ended up working on Envoy. Like, I didn't get it at all. I just know that it'd be fun.
So this was before you were working at Lyft? You had this conversation with Matt?
Yeah. It was almost a year before I joined Lyft that I had this conversation with Matt.
Were you hired directly to work on Envoy?
Yeah, exactly.
What are some of the things that you built or remember from that time?
One of the first things I did was configuration management at Lyft for Envoy. As probably many people know, the configs for Envoy can be very tedious. And so like I... And very verbose, which I am actually a very big fan of. I love verbosity. That's why I love C++.
There's an XML book with a SOAP definition that's sitting right next to you right now. You're like, oh, I miss it so.
Well, yeah. I'm still a little bit peeved about Golang. There's too much magic for me. But yeah, so they work on configuration management because we were at that point where we had hundreds of services and we only had two service templates, one for Golang, one for Python, and we needed to create a way to automatically generate service configs for them, but without having to define every single service. Because what we had at first was that all 100 and something of those services were listed in the configs, but then you ended up with N squared health checks.
Why didn't you just have fewer services? Maybe combine them all into one, perhaps.
But if we're the ones who are setting the path for service mesh, and we go like 150% all in? I'm sorry. We really adopted microservices. And also, that wasn't a question I asked myself at the time. Probably missed a joke there, but not enough caffeine yet. But so I ended up creating a way to create smaller configs. And so I started with that. And then after worked on the config validation with an Envoy. And I also ended up spending quite a bit of time just working with our internal teams at Lyft. I've always did some variation of like customer service in a sense, I guess. And this actually will go to what I've been working on lately at Splunk. I ended up loving answering people's questions like, hey, like, I don't understand what a 404 means. I'm like, oh, well, I know it because I have the operational bias of working on this for months or years at that point. And people don't get it because, you know, like, they don't have to. And so, like, just helping make that education. So I did a bit of internal training and trying to make our docs better. And just also, like, getting to work with people when they say, like, hey, I want to do X. I'm like, wait, do you really want to do X or do you mean Y? But you're only asking for X because you think that's the answer you want. And, like, let's actually talk about it. And so just a lot more of that type of bridge building, I should say.
You mentioned you're working on telemetry and observability.
Yeah.
Is that something that started while you were working at Lyft or something that happened after you moved?
It happened officially after I moved to my next role, but one of the last things I ended up doing at Lyft for Envoy was trying to teach other engineers how to think about Envoy and all its metrics. Mm-hmm. Right? Because, you know, you get thousands of metrics, right? There's a staff for that, which was a joke. There's a staff for that one random thing there. And for anyone who doesn't build Envoy, it's overwhelming. And so, like, I ended up teaching people, like, hey, what's the difference between upstream and downstream? Okay, what does cluster.local_cluster mean? And after, what does cluster.cert, what does cluster.location mean? And trying to build that mental map so when they were on call, they can understand a bit more all of our default dashboards. And so I guess I had started thinking about, one, how to teach other people how to think better about being on call for microservices. And then after, when I started talking to Omnition and they had said like, hey, we have a different way of looking at tracing. When I saw that tool, I was just like, oh, this would have made my 3-hour class about teaching people how to think about a request goes from service A to B to D and you know all the thing there. It was a very intuitive way to think about things, but using tracing instead of metrics. And I was like, wow, this is actually really cool. And that's where I ended up accidentally working on OpenTelemetry.
After working at Lyft, you moved to a company called Omnition, which people may not be as familiar with. Can you talk a little bit about the product that Omnition built?
We were in stealth right before we got acquired by Splunk, but we were working on providing a tool for tracing to visualize what a service map looked like by using tracing data. I guess one of my biggest pet peeves about observability in the tools is that how you interact with the tools are always so tied to how the data is collected, right? When you're searching for logs, you see a text line, 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 right? And so you learn to think about how to answer questions in that. And same thing with metrics. You have a metric, you're going to see some form of a chart. And this was really building a tool to remove how the data was collected and just show you something a lot more intuitive. And so we were able to build a service graph that would say 20% of requests are going from this floating here and there. And like, you didn't have to know that it was using tracing. It didn't matter what the data format underneath it was. It was more to enable people to ask better questions instead of thinking like, okay, well, I'm collecting this metric, so I'm going to see a chart that way. And so we were working on that. And then we got acquired by Splunk at the same time as SignalFX. And so we merged the superpowers of SignalFX tracing with ours to create an amazing tracing product that we've been working on.
You mentioned that you were in stealth.
Yes.
How does a stealth company get acquired?
I don't know.
Surreptitiously.
Was it omniscience on the part of the acquirer to know that you were there and reach out?
I don't know. I had only been there for 6-7 weeks when we got acquired. And I was kind of,
wow.
My initial thought was, whoa, this is too soon. I left a big company to go to a small one. And all my colleagues at Omnition are so amazing. I just wanted to keep on working with them. I'm like, I just want us to be our small team. But Splunk has been great to us.
Has the team stayed together since your acquisition?
Yeah, no one's left. We all still work relatively closely together. Like, some people have moved to like other projects just because they've been in Omnition for a while. But it's definitely been a really happy acquisition, I have to say. Hats off to Splunk in terms of treating us really well and making the transition as smooth as it can be with so many changes in about almost a year now.
You're now contributing to OpenTelemetry, which is a relatively new project. What can you tell us about the work that you're doing there?
I do two things there. One, I'm on the governance committee. I guess view it as upper management for the project, making sure that we're going down the right path. Right? It is kind of like upper management. We're part of a group of 9 of us who are trying to ensure the success of the project, both in terms of adoption, that we're going down the right technical path. And the other part is that I contribute to the collector. One thing, I don't know if people are really aware of this, but when you think about observability, especially if you think about it from the vendor hat, is that instrumentation is usually fairly easy in the sense that either there are a lot of open source libraries or the vendors will provide some form of instrumentation, like libraries you can include there. But the piece that aggregates all the data is usually proprietary. And so the collector is a way to aggregate all that data, both forms of metrics and traces. We have plans for other stuff in the future, but making that open source too. And the collector is really fun because you can do additions to traces like, hey, I forgot to add this one tag, let me add it here. Or I can redact things or do batching and queued retries. And so it's kind of like, it's another proxy, but for traces and metrics.
Building on your communications background, you also do a lot of speaking, notably at KubeCon and at the Velocity Conference. This kind of through line of communications seems to permeate multiple parts of your life. What inspired you to take up public speaking?
It terrified me, so I needed to do it.
I've got a box of spiders and a snake in the other room.
My people are famous for their jumping off bridges.
Bungee jumping, I haven't done yet. I guess a few years back, I started realizing that there's a difference between the healthy fear and the fear of something getting hurt. And I realized that public speaking was that healthy fear where I didn't really know if I was going to be good at it till I try it. And worst case, if I'm not good at it, I can either get better or I can take a step back. And so I decided to try to do it. And also, I think one thing that, I don't know how to say this without sounding braggy, but it's like, I think I'm pretty good at, I call it speaking human. Mm-hmm. We're translating what customers are asking for or into what they're actually trying to do. And especially when you think about like technical talks, right? There's so much focus on, okay, it's almost like a laundry list. Like I did X, I did Y, and then there. But then translating that to like what actually people are trying to do and what problems are trying to solve. Like there's so much more that need for that gray area conversation. And at least if I get to practice doing that, maybe other people start doing it.
As someone who's watched a number of your talks, I can safely say you're a great public speaker, and I hope you continue to do that.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you've learned anything from what you've built in terms of technical communications and technical products to do that, that helped inform how you communicate as an interpersonal communicator and as a public speaker.
Oof.
Always wait for an acknowledgement before you deliver the next line.
ACK.
Are you waiting for an acknowledgement?
No, I am. One thing that's really funny. So we were talking about this before we started recording. I've actually been having nightmares about my KubeCon keynote. That I bombed them, and then after I got laughed out of tech and laughed off of Twitter, which, like, I think being laughed off of Twitter probably would have been a blessing. But regardless of that, right, I still get really nervous about doing public speaking. My keynote for KubeCon is actually about, I did this thing called Design Partners, right? And I am a software engineer by training.
She's making air quotes.
Yeah. Training. And I actually had to be like a mix of software engineer, product management, was it sales engineer, customer support, and...
You sound like you should be a startup founder.
I was going to say, you're a one-woman startup at this point.
Partially. Well, to be fair, like, oh, this is one thing that I forgot to say in my keynote is I had a lot of great support. I'm going to call it Josh Gross, who has been my partner in crime for doing the Design Partners throughout this year. And thankfully, it wasn't a one-person show because there's just so many moving parts. But I had to actually practice learning how do I translate a technical question into an end-user question. And I think that most people just don't ask enough of why. Why are you trying to do something? What are you trying to achieve? Because we usually just want to give the answer right away instead of taking a step back and being like, okay, actually, what are you really trying to do? Because we could give a right answer. We could give what we think is the right answer to the immediate question, but we don't really know how to ask questions, I think. And so the better we are at least asking why and what and how, and for now, because I'm talking to a lot of end users in terms of trying to adopt open telemetry, and I'm like, okay, well, do they have a timeline? If I don't know all those things there, I can just suggest something that is way out of scope for them and they could fail at it. Or if I can understand all the parameters they need or have, I should say constraints, then I can give them better answers. So I think it's more when we come to technical problem solving, we have a very clear understanding of what the goals are, but we forget that a lot of software engineering is actually, it's all soft skills.
A lot of software engineers or technical people will do the five whys in the event of some kind of failure or postmortem. Do you think there's value in having people think about that earlier in the process?
Oh my goodness, yes. I think we answer questions too quickly and we don't spend enough time setting up the problem, right? Why do it in postmortem when you could do it beforehand and potentially avoid some of that pain?
Premortem.
Premortem, yeah.
Mortem implies death. We like not to use that word.
Let's say pre-sprouting, like a garden or something like that. Fertilizing the ground.
Many metaphors we can plumb the depths here.
Let's call it an omniscient meeting where you, you know, predict what's going to happen.
Is that name available? I think Adam would really like to acquire it.
I don't know.
That name's got a lot of, like, there's a lot of road you can drive down with that name. I love it.
Yeah.
So on top of all of your current work and project contributions, you are, of course, the co-chair of KubeCon EU. How did that process start for you?
It's another one of those happy accidents. So I think one thing that ends up happening that maybe... at least what happened for me is that, like, people suggested my name. Mm-hmm. Vicky, who's my other co-chair for EU, we worked together at Lyft. So I think she was one of the people who suggested me. And also from my Envoy work, like, I knew other people within CNCF. And so I think that's how my name ended up popping up. And then Dan reached out to me. He's like, hey, are you interested in this? And I was just like, oh, I, like, bring out the paper bag and breathe through. Just like, are you really sure I can do this? Like, I need to breathe through this because, like, I don't know what I'm doing. And so that's kind of how it happened. And I was like, okay, like, this is another example, like, this scares me. So let's just see if I can do it and what I can learn from it. And I said, yes.
The first responsibilities for the chairs is to set the direction through the program. Did you go through the entire selection process, call for papers and so on, before the conference went virtual?
Well, technically EU didn't go virtual until like 2-3 months ago, right? But we did postpone it in early May. I think what's really interesting about EU, right, is that EU, both in terms of the content and, you know, there are a lot of great additions to make the virtual interactions more interactive, but it was all set as if to be in person. So North America, what would have been Boston, right, is a lot more conscious about how to do the virtual part. But EU was like, we had done all the talk selections by end of January.
The agenda had been published before the decision to defer the conference?
Yes, because I think it had been published early February, if I remember correctly. Oh my goodness, that feels like...
forever ago?
2 years ago. Yeah. We have CFPs, but we haven't done any of the reviews for Boston yet, or what would have been Boston, I should say. And so I know that Steven, who's my co-chair for Boston, we've joked around, like, maybe we should, kind of like your green screen, Adams, like, maybe we should actually set up, you know, one of those, like, smoking chairs and get those velvet smoking jackets and just, like, you know, have, like, a welcome room where we're like, hey, everyone, welcome to KubeCon North America. And just, you know, kind of be, like, everyone's chaperone into the event and make that virtual part a little funny, interactive, because Steven and I are both goofballs.
That would be great. The little fire, the sheepdog lying at the lap, the whole.
Exactly.
Speaking of those kind of changes, what has going virtual changed in the planning that you've had to do for the event?
This is where the CNCF, like the planning committee, the conference, they actually deserve all the credit for that, because we're more responsible for the content and choosing who to speak, and we give ideas, but they're the ones who are more involved in terms of trying to find those activities. I think, right, we probably can all, at least for me, some of the best things about KubeCon is the hallway track, right? Is bumping into someone and be like, hey, I saw you talk and I just thought that was really cool. And then you end up having like a 3-hour long conversation.
That's all Slack now. How are we feeling about that?
I am not the biggest fan of that, but it's mostly because I don't really know what to say. I think I'm more responsive. Like if I see someone smile, then I could be like, oh, is that funny too? And so I find it personally awkward, but I know other people are more comfortable with it. We're just trying to find ways to make that type of, I guess what, another happy accident in terms of talking to people easier. And so Slack is one way we're trying right now. And I know for some people who maybe do get anxious about the in-person communication, that will be easier, and that's great. And so I think it's all very much a moment to think about how do we do interactions and how do we build communities and make them stronger and more inclusive, especially since we don't get that in-person interaction. But also that opens up to people who can't travel, right? Because traveling is really expensive. Like now they have better opportunities to join these conversations and meet people.
That's worth going into. So obviously the program was predominantly set before the change was made in the case of the Europe conference. Were there a lot of people who have had to pull out as a result of this and not be able to present?
I don't remember that many, actually.
What about the converse then? Like, will the early virtual situation for Boston mean that there are more people who can take part who may have not been able to travel in the past?
Yeah, I think in terms of attendees, I can't remember in terms of applications. Like, I don't remember what our statistics were for that. But I do think it opens it up for more people. Like, as long as you have steady internet, which I know isn't quite a human right yet, but it should be, to study high-speed internet, I think it should make it easier. But I know that's forward-looking. I guess the one problem is, like, there's still going to be time zones. There's still going to be a little bit of a language barrier. That part's a little hard. And also, depending on your situation, sometimes you don't have access to a quiet space, right? And so that sometimes can be a little hard to interact with. So I would like to say, yes, I hope it does. But I also know that it isn't always the case. And something probably we have to think about more about future things to solve.
What are you most excited about that the change to being virtual will make possible that wasn't possible before?
Ooh, I really don't know.
Not having jet lag?
No, that's true. I will say chances of me losing my voice now are almost slim to none. But I will say also, I tend to think more in the present. And so I'm excited to hear all the talks, but like I don't really know what I'm going to be excited for until the moment I'm in it. And so I think maybe that's something for me to respond with in reflection after the fact.
Do you think that this change is going to affect a permanent change in KubeCon?
Of course. I think it's forcing us to think about interactions differently. And one thing that's been really great about the conference is just we've always been acting on a feedback loop. There's things like, what was it, after San Diego, people were talking about the 101 track. And so we started adding a 101 track for EU. You remember, like, what was it, the puppies and the coloring and all that quiet thing from San Diego, right? Like those are things we incorporated because of people's feedback. Mm-hmm. And so I think the precedent has already been set from CNCF in terms of how to take feedback, that what we will learn from this will definitely incorporate going forward.
Will there be some service whereby a puppy is delivered to my house for the duration of KubeCon?
Probably not. I think that one is pretty expensive.
A shame.
I can send corgi photos. I have a corgi.
We'll put them in the show notes.
I think there's also what that llama that you can like hire to join like a Zoom call or something like that. That might be the best, but you don't get the actual presence of petting a dog and the dog cuddling with you.
If you were to look into your crystal ball, see, I'm not going to make the joke, but if you're going to look into your crystal ball for what the changes are that you think we will learn out of this KubeCon that will help inform future KubeCons, what do you think some of the biggest pieces of that will be?
I think one is, I imagine that some form of Slack or IM in chat will probably be a lot more present if, you know, we do go back to having more person conferences, because I think that's always probably the hardest thing is that sometimes you want to meet up with someone and you don't have their number, but at least you can send them a Slack. I think that will make that interaction a little easier. I think when people are partially in the office and not, like that virtual aspect, I think we'll just start incorporating a lot more of the virtual aspect into these interactions. And what might be cool is having maybe like a multi-tiered model where there is an in-person aspect, but there's also the aspect to like stream in. So that way those who can't make it can at least watch it live and maybe ask questions. And so probably just having more of that incorporated, but, you know, without forgetting to actually turn on your mic and camera like everyone does when they're in the conference room and they forget about that one person who's remote.
We talked to your co-chair, Vicky Chung, in episode 80, and we asked her what advice she would give to her as then yet unannounced conference co-chair. And she said that she'd recommend looking for the unexpected content in the CFP process. Is that something that you were able to bring to this event?
I would like to say I think so. Going back to January, Constance, I think, yeah, the unexpected content. Definitely, I agree with that. I think we did a pretty good job of trying to have some variety. I think this is maybe a call to action to anyone who wants to submit CFPs. If you have a crazy idea, just submit it. If you think it's crazy, if it's related to the CNCF project, just do it. Do it in a sense of like, I learned this thing about trying to use this project. This is how it failed. I would love to see more failure stories. Because I think we have a lot of talks about, I deployed this and this, and it worked really well. But it's like, I want to hear like, hey, you know what? We tried this and this failed miserably. And it's not meant to be bashing the project. It's meant to be more like, we didn't understand that these constraints were going to happen. And so let me at least tell you about it, because chances are someone else is going to do it.
This would be the Tales of Woe track.
Yeah, that's where the puppies would be waiting right after the talks.
There'll just be a little dachshund on each chair as you sit down. Just start petting it now.
Maybe even whiteboards at the back, because someone could be like, hey, I had that problem too. But like, let's at least try to work it through, because I think like if we would have changed this thing there. And we need more whiteboards at conferences. That's what we really need.
Is that the advice that you'll be passing on to Stephen as your co-chair for the November event?
More whiteboards. Oh, I feel like yes. More whiteboards. More jokes. I think we do a good job of the after events in terms of being fun and more of that social interaction, but also just making things more lighthearted in general. Yes. Whiteboards and more puppies and cats, if you're not a dog person. And also hypoallergenic for those who do have allergies.
And a pony.
Yes, ponies too.
Because I want a pony.
It will come as no surprise to everybody that with the move to the virtual event, and especially the fact that not everyone is in the same time zone as the actual event, that there will be a large amount of pre-recorded content at this event. Were your keynotes pre-recorded?
Yes, they were pre-recorded.
So why the nightmares about giving them?
Because...
you know how they went.
Sometimes like you have this expectation in your head and you don't know if it's actually how it got received. And so I think I did a decent job. I always wish I could have prepared more, because who doesn't create conference talks like in the last 2 days or, you know, there. But it's also because one, it means a lot to me. And also I want for everyone who's attending, like I want it to be worth their time. And so I hope that they find it valuable and there's something to take away from it, because I think part of the thing that we forget is that we're doing it for the audience, for them to take something away. And so I want to make sure that I gave a good enough presentation that they feel like I respected their time. And I hope I did, but you never know. Your brain is always mean to you when you're just like doing something really important and it comes up with ways to make you doubt yourself.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm sure you'll do great given what I've seen you do previously. Are you looking forward to the days when you'll be able to get back on a real stage with a live audience and the energy in that room?
Yes. That is one thing that I am sad about, is that as co-chair, I will never be in front of the massive room. It's just selfishly, like I wish it kind of feels like a little bit of that validation of, hey, I made it here. But I do look forward to it, even though it's terrifying.
It's a big stage.
It's a massive stage. When Matt, Jose, and I were in front of Seattle, was it almost 2 years ago? I couldn't stop shaking. And it was terrifying, but it was also just be like, hey, I did this. Kind of crazy. And even 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I never thought I could do it. And now I'm here. And to just view that growth is just mind-blowing. And so it's a very notable way to measure some accomplishment, and that would have been really lovely to have. But everyone's safety is way more important than my fear of being in front of thousands of people.
Finally, Karamanlis is a Greek name. Now, you worked on two projects in this very Greek ecosystem called Envoy and OpenTelemetry. Are you a bit disappointed, and do you have a favorite Greek-named project?
I don't. I actually kind of forget that I'm Greek until I think about food.
Do you have a favorite Greek food?
Ooh, yes. So there's this thing called Halatoburiko. It's a milk custardy pie, a phyllo pie that's just so delicious. That or loukoumades, which is like Greek donuts or deep fried in honey, or just lamb. Like lamb is great. And also real tomatoes.
Is there any Dutch food that you're looking forward to enjoying this week?
The stroop waffles. Also, all the pickled fish. When I was in Amsterdam a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, whenever it was, there's this really cute little restaurant that has amazing like pickled fish, and that was really good too, like on a sandwich. I love all food.
What do you dip French fries in?
Depends. Sometimes mayo, sometimes ketchup, sometimes a mixture of the two.
Good answer.
But never brown sauce.
Oh, are you talking about gravy?
No, HP sauce. It's a British thing. It was last week's episode. You had to be there.
But also, like, if I'm in Quebec, then I'm going to want poutine, which is going to be gravy and curd cheese, which is so good, too. Oof, yeah.
Constance, thank you so much for joining us this week. I'm sure you did great on the keynote.
Thank you for having me. It was great talking to both of you.
You can find Constance on Twitter at CCARAMAN OLIS. And you can check out Virtual KubeCon EU this week at KubeCon.io. Thanks for listening. As always, if you enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com. And if you're on KubeCon this week, you can find us in the Slack at #Kubernetes-podcast.
You can also check out our website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you will find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe. Until next week, take care.
Catch you next week.